As soon as the thorns started growing, Beth was moving in their direction. Emily and Nico were likewise setting themselves up to launch attacks the moment the thorns no longer obscured Jason's team. "Clive and Neil, go," Humphrey said through the voice chat. Not needing to move to cast spells, Neil and Clive both started chanting lengthy incantations. It was enough time that Beth was able to rush to the edge of the thorns and chant her own spell. On completion, she opened her mouth, from which streamed a wave of green spores flooded over the field of thorns. They all started getting messages from Jason's interface power. "Spell, Spore Cloud, has inflicted spore toxin on you. You have resisted Spore Cloud. Spore Cloud does not take effect. You have gained an instance of resistant." Stuck in the cloud, the messages kept repeating. Only Jason resisted all the spores, but Sophie's aura helped the others resist many of them. Jason used his Feast of Absolution on Clive and Neil to cleanse them as they chanted their spells. Neil completed his, and in the air above the thorns, an ornate water fountain appeared, floating in the air. It sprayed water down over the people in the thorn field, healing their wounds. "Spell, Fountain of Life, is healing you over time." Shortly after, Clive completed his spell. High in the sky, a magical light traced out the shape of a huge eye in red and gold light. "You have entered a zone affected by the Eye of Karma. When you suffer damage, the originator of that damage will also suffer damage." "Now!" Humphrey yelled, and the whole team started pushing themselves into the thorns. The floating fountain constantly healed them, even as the thorns injured them. Beth shrieked as the retributive damage of five people being pierced all over their body tore her flesh to ribbons. When she died, the thorns withered, leaving the fountain to heal them of any remaining damage. As the thorns withered, a hail of arrows fell from the sky and fire breath washed over them as Emily took the chance to strike. It was too little, too late though, with the fountain still healing them. With their team outnumbering the survivors of both the others combined, the outcome was inevitable. Rick and Nico formed a temporary alliance, but were overpowered by Humphrey, Sophie, Neil, and Clive. Jason, meanwhile, hounded Emily. Unlike with a normal pursuer, she never knew which shadow he would appear from, and quickly realized running was pointless. Instead, she made herself ready to pepper him with arrows if he emerged. In the end, he baited her. When he appeared from the shadows, she fired her strongest special attack while retreating, creating distance between them. She backed right into a waiting mass of leeches. The control room of the Mirage Chamber had extra platforms installed to accommodate 14 people. The participants all got up and stretched. Their real bodies had been lying comfortably, yet they all felt exhausted. Beth moved over to Humphrey, shaking his hand.
"You completely anticipated me," she told him. "It was a good win." "That's the disadvantage of being the best adventurer in the city," he told her, unable to hide his victorious smile. "Everyone's paying attention to your abilities."
"That was very good," Danielle said, standing next to the control panel.
"I agree," Emiya said, standing next to her. "You will all have a good chance in my little contest."
"When are you going to fill in some more details about that?" Jason asked.
"Only once your competition has arrived in the city," Emiya said. "That should be any day now."
Chapter 31 Arrival.
"You can begin, Candidate Wexler," Vincent said. The Adventure Society official with the outrageous mustache was leading Sophie's assessment, just as he had Jason's. Sophie nodded as she stepped off the road and into the field of crops taller than she was.
"There were 9 grass darters reported," Vincent said to the other candidates. "While Candidate Wexler chases them down, we will have time to discuss the remainder of the day's notices. Those of you who have yet to demonstrate your aptitude to a satisfactory level should be looking to volunteer."
He trailed off and looked to the crops, where Sophie emerged, struggling to carry 4 dead beetles the size of small dogs. The group watched as she dumped them onto the road, each with a fist-sized hole in its carapace.
According to the Magic Society listing, Sophie said, the shells of these things are pretty valuable. You said you knew harvesting rituals, right, Clay?
Yes, Clay said. Were they already dead?
If they were already dead, they'd be rainbow smoke already, Sophie said. Just harvest this lot and we'll go even split. I'll go pick up some more.
How did you catch them so fast?
Another candidate asked. I think these ones are duds, Sophie said. The Magic Society listing said they were fast, but these seemed a bit sluggish. Can't hide their auras either, so my perception power makes them easy to find.
Sophie ducked back into the field.
I wouldn't put much stock in what Candidate Wexler considers slow, Vincent advised the other candidates. Her perspective is somewhat skewed.
At the marshalling yard, Jason and Belinda were part of the crowd waiting for the return of Sophie's assessment group. It was the first Adventure Society intake since the expedition. The last one had been cancelled in the wake of that disaster and the incursion of the inquiry team. For this assessment, Vincent had been paired up with a member of that team who mostly watched in silence. It was also a smaller group than usual, with families suddenly more wary about placing their young people in the path of potential harm.
She'll pass, right? Belinda asked nervously.
She should, Jason said. Vincent won't just give her an easy pass, but she's better than I was when I took my assessment.
She's better than you are now, Neil said. Their whole team was waiting for her in solidarity.
I'll have you know people find me very scary, Jason said.
You're wearing a pink shirt with tropical flower print, Neil said.
They could be poisonous flowers, you don't know.
My concern is the member of the Inquisition team they sent, Humphrey said. He's meant to be assessing Vincent's execution of the assessment, but he may just make them fail everyone as some kind of example.
They could have just sent Rufus for that, Jason said. He failed everyone when he ran the assessment.
He didn't fail me, Neil said. He did me, Humphrey said.
He failed me before it even started, Jason said. He wouldn't let me go, told me not to bother because I was definitely going to fail.
Was he right? Clive asked.
Oh, yeah, Jason said. A few weeks earlier, I was an assistant manager at an office supply store.
A what store? Belinda asked.
Office supplies, Jason said. The Station Eerie, where we're hawkish about your office supply needs.
Does this make sense to anyone? Neil asked.
It's best just to let him go and not ask questions, Clive said. That way lies madness, believe me.
I am curious about his world, though, Belinda said.
There are a lot of differences, Jason said. More pamphlets, for example. You go to an accommodation and they'll have a stand of pamphlets for local attractions.
I haven't seen that here.
Pamphlets, Neil said flatly.
Yeah, Jason said. Folded pieces of paper with information printed on them.
You don't seem to have a lot of them here. Maybe I should start a business. I could be a pamphlet mogul.
Is it too late to change teams? Neil asked. Someone must be looking for a healer. A wagon rolled its way into the marshalling yard, Adventure Society candidates climbing out as it came to a stop. After a few words from Vincent, they broke off to meet with their families, some looking confident, others morose. Vincent exchanged a brief chat with the inquiry official before following Sophie over to their group.
How do you think you did?
Belinda asked, giving Sophie a hug.
You'll have to ask this guy,
Sophie said, jabbing a thumb in Vincent's direction.
We'll make our assessment reports today, and final results go up tomorrow, Vincent said. I don't think Candidate Wexler has anything to be concerned about, though.
How is the inquiry official? Humphrey asked.
Tough, but fair, Vincent said. He didn't demand quite as high a standard as Rufus, but he certainly wasn't going to tolerate the usual Greenstone standard.
So, can we expect better adventurers from now on? Clive said.
For a while, Vincent said. How long it takes to fall back into old patterns, who knows?
Adventure Society culture is set at the top, and Elspeth Arella isn't what I'd hoped she'd be.
My mother hates working with her, Humphrey said. She wasn't happy Arella held onto her position, but this threat from the Builder pushes aside everything else for now.
Speaking of which, Neil said, did your mother say anything about Thadwick?
Not much, Humphrey said. After they caught him, she watched the purging ritual herself. It seems to have extracted the starseed intact, but Thadwick was fairly ravaged by the process. Last I heard, he hasn't woken up from the healing yet.
Thanks, Neil said. I hated being on his team, but I've known him most of my life. He didn't deserve that.
He tried to kill me that one time, so I kind of think he does, Jason said.
The suffering part, at least. I'm glad he's not dead.
To finish the job yourself, Sophie posited.
No, Jason said. Thalia Mercer knows her son's a useless dimwit, but she'd still kill me if I did. Then my friends would go after Mercer's and on. I'm going to do what I should have done when I first met the guy and let it go.
That's a mature attitude, Vincent said.
I'm still going to make fun of him, though, Jason said.
A lot. That guy sucks.
That's slightly less mature, Vincent said. But I'll take it.
Sophie vaulted over the gap between the old city rooftops, sailing through the crisp morning air to land with delicacy and precision. The sun was only just peeking over the delta, beginning to banish the cold of night. Gary was close behind Sophie, his leaps heavy and powerful compared to her light agility. Jason was a distant third, his cloak floating around him as it let him easily make the distance. On Jason's heels was Humphrey, manifesting wings to cross the gap. Bringing up the rear were Clive, Neil, and Belinda, who balked at the jump, stopping at the edge of the roof.
I can't make that jump, Neil said, breathing hard.
Not with that attitude, Gary called back.
We don't have movement powers, Clive said. I can only teleport other people.
Teleport me over then, Belinda said.
Why should you get the teleport? Neil asked. You aren't even an essence user yet.
And I still have to do this awful training, Belinda shot back. That's why I should get the teleport.
No one's getting the teleport, Clive said.
He backed up, broke into a run, and vaulted the gap, successfully reaching the other side.
Why do I even need to do this? Neil asked. I don't have any mobility powers.
Which makes it all the more important, Humphrey said. It means that if it comes down to it, the skills you're developing now will be all you have to rely on. What happened to the man who was eager to train?
I want to train the things I'm good at.
That's all well and good, Gary said. But it's the things you aren't good at that get you killed.
Neil groaned, but moved for a run-up before barely clearing the gap.
Not bad, Gary said, thumping him heavily on the back.
That left only Belinda on the other rooftop, eyeing off the jump when an angry man climbed up from a window.
Who's jumping up and down on my roof, first thing in the bloody morning?
The team looked at each other uncertainly. Then Clive chanted a spell.
Exchange your fates.
Belinda and Neil switched position, bringing Belinda into the group and leaving Neil with the angry homeowner.
Leg it!
Jason yelled, and they all started sprinting.
Oh, come on, Neil complained as he watched them go.
Then he turned awkwardly to the man whose roof he was standing on.
Well? The man demanded.
I'm with the Adventure Society, Neil said.
Is there a monster up here?
The man asked, casting a gaze around.
No, Neil admitted. No, there isn't.
Then get off my bloody roof!
A crowd was gathered at a dock in the old city port that had been completely cleared for the approaching ship.
Why do you need me here for this? Rufus asked. I'm meant to be making final inspections of the annex site this morning before giving the go-ahead to break ground.
You are still my contracted agent here, Emir said. That's why you came here in the first place, which makes any other ventures of secondary concern.
Since when do you care about that? Rufus asked.
Since now, Emir said. Shut up and get ready to greet the people as they disembark.
They had spotted the approaching ship from the Cloud Palace. Full of Emir's recruited Iron Rankers, it would normally have used the Adventure Society's private dock,
but that was currently claimed by the Cloud Palace. Instead, room had been made at the regular port.
You realize you've thrown this whole port into chaos, right? Rufus asked. They weren't expecting to have some gold ranker come in and just claim a whole dock.
The entire point of being a gold ranker is to have other people deal with all the mundane problems.
And here was me thinking it was to protect civilization from monsters, Rufus said. That's a life lesson, I guess.
Rufus made his way through the gathering of Adventure Society officials, Emir's staff, dock workers, and adventurers, arriving dockside as the ship approached the dock. Rufus's eyes went wide as he spotted a man on board with midnight skin and dark, curly hair tied back behind his head. The man spotted him too, and he launched off the boat, sailing through the air on a magical wind to land in front of Rufus.
"Hello, boy," the man said.
"Hello, Dad," Rufus said.
"What are you doing here?"
Chapter 32. Full Jason. As the boat was still moving into the dock, the aeronautical early arrival of Gabriel Ramore drew quite a lot of attention. The curious crowd pressed in for only a moment, though, before he pressured them back with his gold rank aura.
"I see you haven't been working on subtlety while I've been away," Rufus said. "Gods, you sound like your mother. She told me I shouldn't fly over."
"She's here too," Rufus asked, gaze moving from his father to the approaching ship.
"Oh, now you show some emotional investment," Gabriel said.
"Maybe if you didn't make everything about yourself," Rufus said. "Flying over here in front of all these people, what were you thinking?"
"That I could comfort my precious son?"
"Then why didn't you bring mother?"
The mirth dropped off Gabriel's face as he turned to look at the ship.
"She's with the Hurons," he said.
Rufus's face was stricken.
"Farah's parents?" he asked feebly.
"They wanted to come."
Rufus reeled on the spot.
I should have brought her home straight away."
"It's all right,"
Gabriel said, placing a comforting hand on his son's shoulder.
"I won't say it wasn't hard on them, because how could it not be? But those of us with adventurer children know the adventurers don't always come home."
"I was supposed to protect her."
"You were supposed to lead her, and you did."
Gabriel looked around at the gathered people watching them. He had already used his wind abilities to make their conversation private, but there was no shortage of onlookers.
"You're right," he said to his son. "I shouldn't have jumped over like that."
Rufus was bleary-eyed, but gave his father a smile.
"If you didn't make a spectacle of yourself, I'd suspect you of being some kind of shapeshifter."
"That's kind of hurtful."
"You did an unscheduled fire sword dance at my academy graduation," Rufus said.
Gabriel chuckled.
"Your granddad gave me an earful for that one."
Emir passed through the wind bubble, keeping in the sound, and gave Gabriel a welcoming hug.
"How was the trip, Gabe?"
"It was good," Gabriel said.
"You know I could have had Hester portal you in," Emir said.
"Annabelle wanted to take the long way," Gabriel told him. "All those stops picking up the Iron Rankers gave us the chance to see some new places. It was good for the Hurons."
"With you, me, and Annabelle here, you should have brought Cal too," Emir said. "Get the old team together for a reunion."
"You know what he's like," Gabriel said. "If there's no monsters worth fighting, he's not interested. You couldn't drag him into a low magic zone like this one."
"He doesn't change, does he?" Emir asked, glancing at the boat. "They'll be getting ready to disembark soon. I'd best go greet all the tadpoles."
Emir was in front of a gathered group of Iron Rankers. Some 60 or so had been on the boat, with two more boats still coming.
"Welcome to Greenstone," Emir said. "My name is Emir Bahadir, and I'd like to thank you all personally for coming all this way in response to my contract. As to the specifics, there will be a large announcement meeting once all of the adventurers have arrived.
In the meantime, I suggest you report your arrival to the local branch of the Adventure Society. I've arranged a number of carriages to take you all there directly, and they can help you find local accommodation."
Adventurers didn't have luggage, instead carrying their possessions in dimensional bags or dimensional space abilities. They were trained to travel light and with efficiency, and were soon heading for the island in a train of carriages. Not all of them took the offered ride, heading straight off to explore Old City, or hanging around the dock instead, hoping for some personal time with Emir. Others were greeted by representatives of Greenstone's nobility, or other prominent families. Every other family in Greenstone envied the power and influence the Gellers held in other lands, and leapt at the chance to make outside connections. They hoped that playing host to the next generation of leaders would get them a foot in the door of a larger world. This was reinforced by the Geller family itself, who sent representatives to collect certain people to which they had connections. Emir sent away most of those looking to make an early connection, all but a young girl of only 15 years, with dark skin and rainbow-coloured hair that fell back over her head in a series of tight braids.
"Kettis," Emir greeted her warmly.
"Grandfather?" she said, with a respectful nod.
"No hug for your granddad."
She gave him a hug after glancing around with a self-consciousness of her age.
"How was your trip?" he asked.
"The boat was so small," she complained,
drawing a laugh from Emir.
"Of course it was small after the cloud ship," he said. "It's good for you to broaden your perspective."
"You don't broaden your perspective by narrowing the ship," she said sullenly,
and Emir laughed again.
"Did you enjoy travelling with Auntie Annabel?"
She nodded.
"All right," he said. "Come along as I say hello. I have a present for you later."
They wandered over to where Rufus and his father were talking with three other people. Rufus's mother, Arabelle, had even darker skin than her husband, her long hair dyed rainbow colours in the Vitesse style. Farah's parents, the Hurons, were fair-skinned like their daughter had been. Emir knew that while they looked older than the Ramores, Amelia and William Huron were actually younger. Of humble origins, they had become adventurers later in life. As young parents, they had stumbled upon the valuable potent essence. Instead of selling it for its considerable value, they kept it hidden as they worked to obtain more. By the time their daughter was old enough to use them, the Hurons had the more common fire and earth essences to go with it. It was only after their daughter found success as an adventurer that she repaid the gift twice over, and they too became essence users. Farah's parents had no interest in following their daughter into the Adventure Society. They were both bronze rank, having raised their abilities using the monster cores Farah brought back from her adventures. Rufus and Gary had likewise contributed their own shares. As Emir approached, Rufus bowed before them, practically kneeling.
"I'm so sorry," he told them. "Please, stop apologizing," Farah's mother, Amelia, said. "Our daughter died as an adventurer, and she died proudly. You're no more to blame than we are for giving her those essences in the first place."
"We had an informal wake a couple of weeks ago," Rufus said. "Now you're here, I'll arrange something more formal." The two sets of parents shared a glance over Rufus's bowed head.
"You do that," Farah's father, William, said. "We'd appreciate it, son."
In the Cloud Palace training hall, Humphrey and Sophie were clashing while Jason, Neil, Clive, and Belinda rested in the observation area. Humphrey had his smaller conjured sword out, Sophie deflecting it with her fists.
"When I get my own essences," Belinda told Clive, "I think I'll prefer to fight at range, like you. Getting up close like that is really more Sophie's area."
"That can be tricky for a human," Neil said. "Humans get more special attacks than anything else, unless you get a racial gift evolution early, like Clive. Mostly that means melee attacks. If you want range, then a bow essence would be a good choice. That's the most reliable way to get ranged special attacks."
"Or you could get an ability that lets you use skill books," Clive said. "That way, you can gain whatever skills you need. The adept essence is a solid bet in that case."
I looked at the bow essence, but decided against it, Belinda said. Adept is on my list, though.
You're already pucking out essences? Neil asked.
Clive let me look at the Magic Society essence listings, Belinda said. I've picked out a set I like the look of. They're all common essences, so they shouldn't be that hard to get.
You've made a decision, Clive said. What combination?
Magic, Adept, and Trap, she said.
Magic and Adept are popular essences, but not hard to find, Clive said. Trap is more of a niche selection. Mostly assassin and hunter types go for it. I think it's an undervalued essence when it comes to monster hunting.
What's the confluence essence for that? Neil asked.
Charlatan, Belinda said with glee. I was looking through the abilities it's known to give, and they sound fantastic.
Neil and Clive shared a glance. Charlatan? Neil asked.
From recollection, Clive said, it's a confluence more people avoid than seek out. Most would disagree with you on the value of the abilities it gives.
Then those people lack imagination, Belinda said. I look through long lists of abilities. I don't want to pick out some essences looking for fun, tricky abilities, only to end up with a boring set of straightforward attacks. Ideally, I'd get one of those racial gift evolutions that means I'm not stuck shooting 9 kinds of magic arrow.
We fought a couple of people in the Mirage Chamber recently who might disagree, Neil said.
Those people lost, Belinda said. Maybe they would have done better if they had more tricks in their pocket.
Harsh, Jason said. I have to agree with the value of having a few hidden surprises at the ready, though.
As do I, Emir said, as the elevating platform brought him up into the room. Speaking of surprises, I believe you have something for me.
Clive pushed himself out of the chair, took a heavy book from his storage space, and handed it to Emir.
Skill book, Way of the Reaper, Form 3. You aren't still holding out on me, are you? Emir asked. Jason told me you didn't take anything from that complex you found.
I said no such thing, Jason said. If you think back, you'll find I dodged the question. If I went telling high rankers every time I found something interesting, they'd just keep taking them off me.
Is that why you kept your and Miss Wexler's unusual combat style from me for so long?
I thought it was best if your interest in her was purely altruistic, Jason said. It was her choice to tell you. She wanted to thank you for taking her in when you had no need to.
My client is very interested in the origin of that fighting style, Emir said. Once our business here is done, I suspect he will have an interest in tracing Miss Wexler's family history. Perhaps once her indenture is done, she will be interested in that journey for herself.
That's up to her, Jason said. So this granddaughter of yours has been learning the Way of the Reaper too?
My search has taken time and found many relics of the Order of the Reaper, Emir said. That includes skill books. My granddaughter can use skill books and was very interested in practicing a lost style. I was reluctant, having only recovered books containing 3 of the 5 forms. In the end, she wore me down.
Your client didn't want the books, Clive asked. My client appreciates any relics I send his way and pays me appropriately, but I am only contracted for 1 item. We have found multiple copies of these skill books and had some to spare, but only for 3 of the forms. We haven't found anything for the 2nd or 3rd.
We found intact copies of Forms 1 and 3, Clive said. We can't help you with a book for Form 2. I'm not so sure about that, Emir said. My hope is that one will be recovered during the upcoming contest, Emir said. I will share the details once the other boats arrive. Even if not, both you and Miss Wexler have knowledge of Form 2, do you not, Jason?
We do. We're grateful for all you've done for us, so we'd be happy to teach her what we can.
That's excellent, Emir said. You'll meet her soon. Have you met Rufus's parents yet?
Not yet, Jason said. Rufus and Gary have been with them and Farrah's parents since they arrived.
Rufus had a request for you for when you meet his father.
Oh? Jason asked.
Rufus's father, Gabriel, likes to make a big first impression. He didn't tell Rufus he was coming, then made quite the entrance at the port.
So I've heard, Jason said.
Rufus requested that when you meet his father, you go what he referred to as full Jason, whatever that means.
Oh, we know what that means, Neil said.
Yes, we do, Clive said.
What are you two talking about? Jason said. Questioned if I was even an elf, then accused me of being fat, Neil said.
You claim to have slept with my non-existent wife, then accused me of sleeping with your non-existent wife.
Neil's an elf? Belinda asked. Yes, I'm an elf.
You are quite hefty for an elf.
My proportions are perfectly normal.
I see it now, Amir said. This is exactly what Rufus was looking for. He had his landlady yell at me.
Chapter 33. Versatile. Jason was sitting in a meditation pose on one of the Cloud Palace's open terraces when Rufus wandered along with his parents.
This is Jason, Rufus said.
Jason turned his head and opened one eye to look before springing lightly to his feet.
Gabriel and Arabelle Ramore, Rufus said. So, this is the Jason Asano I've heard so much about, Gabriel said.
You have? Jason asked, surprise clear on his face.
Most people only pay attention to the big names, you know? Statler, Marantz, the ones with all the fancy glazing techniques, the overdone vases that no one ever actually uses as a vase. I mean, seriously, if the form overwhelms the function, what's the point, am I right?
Glazing?
Gabrielle asked in confusion.
I know, right?
Jason asked. The true enthusiast understands that it isn't about the flashy finish, but the craftsmanship of the underlying product. Every aficionado who truly knows their business understands that the real collectible is also the most practical. They don't go for the weird oversized bowls or the fancy jugs with artistic flourishes that compromise volume. They know that solid, economical designs are what really endure.
I'm sorry, Gabriel said, but what are you talking about?
Pottery, Jason said.
That's why you heard about me, right?
And I can tell you that the rumors are true. I have the best clay-to-coin ratio in Greenstone. You want practical, affordable earthenware, then I'm your guy.
Pottery.
Oh, yeah, Jason said, enthusiastically. I'm not just about the pots and bowls, either. You want the inside skinny on the industry, then I'm your man. Jason narrowed his eyes, giving the remorse an assessing look, then leaned in conspiratorially.
Because you're Rufus's family, Jason said, I might have a little inside tip for you.
I think there may have been a mistake, Gabriel said.
No mistake, my friend, Jason said, giving Gabriel a pat on the arm. You want the inside scoop? The hidden truth the other earthenware merchants won't tell you? You can forget the vases, my friend. The bowls, pots, pitchers, planters and jugs. I know they're all the fancy eye-catching stuff the ordinary collectors go for. And those big-name potters, they're more than happy to feed them the dross while keeping the real goods for themselves.
What is happening? Gabriel asked, looking at his son in confusion.
The future is happening, Jason said. Not just the future of pottery, as if that wasn't exciting enough, but the future of beverages themselves.
Beverages?
Oh, yes, my friend. I know it seems like everyone stores wine in bottles these days, but take it from an industry insider. Amphora are coming back in a big way.
Amphora?
That's the stuff, Jason said.
These aren't your grandmother's amphora. They're not just for wine anymore. Milk, tea, juice, liquor, Bovril.
Bovril?
Oh, I forgot you don't have cows here. Lizard Bovril? Forget the Bovril. Focus on the amphora.
I realize that every good collector has an amphora or two squirreled away somewhere. They're always an addendum, though, a punctuation point in a piquant pottery poem. But I'm here to tell you, friend, that amphora are about to explode onto the scene that will make vases look like little dishes people use for hard candy.
I really don't understand what's happening, Gabriel said.
Of course you don't, Jason said, moving next to Gabriel and slipping a sympathetic arm over his shoulder. Even as we speak, the potters of the world are hidden away, crafting amphora after amphora for the bonanza to come.
Gabriel pulled himself away from Jason, which did nothing to dampen Jason's enthusiasm.
I very clearly missed something in this situation, Gabriel said.
Of course you have, Jason said. But that isn't your fault.
It's these so-called industry professionals, collection agents, and gallery owners. They know the truth, but will they tell good, honest collectors like you? No, they won't. It's a conspiracy, my friend, an amphora conspiracy, to keep you out of the game until the market explodes and they hold all the cards.
I'm very confused, Gabriel said.
I know, Jason said, sympathetically. Some poor, innocent pottery enthusiast can't be expected to understand the market nuances and industry secrets.
That's surely why Rufus brought you to me, right?
Oh, I definitely brought him here for this, Rufus said.
There you are, Jason said. Clearly you're a gentleman of insight and means.
Jason leaned over to Rufus.
He is a man of means, right?
Jason whispered loudly.
Oh, yes, Rufus said, and Jason gave Gabriel a beaming smile.
Insight and means, he said again. A man who won't miss an opportunity literally hidden away from the more ordinary collector. Let me paint you a picture. A workshop filled with secretive but capable apprentices, all under the direction of an experienced and rakishly handsome man with almost months of experience. Rack after rack of amphora. No bowls, no pots, no jugs, just one amphora after another, poised for that market shift, ready to explode in prominence.
Are you trying to get me to give you money? Gabriel asked.
It's not about money, Jason said. It's about showing those with an iron grip on the industry that we can bust open their artificial scarcity.
And also money. You drop 7 or 8 gold spirit coins now, and a few years down the track, you could very well have made some of it back.
Good?
Hold on, I have a pamphlet here somewhere.
Pamphlet?
Jason patted his pockets absently. Then his face lit up as he remembered, and he plucked a pamphlet out of the air, shoving it into Gabriel's hand. Gabriel looked warily at the cover.
Step 1, collect underpants, he read.
Oops, Jason said, snatching back the pamphlet and shoving it into his inventory. He then pulled out a fistful of pamphlets and started leafing through them, reading to himself as he went.
Church of Om, not a lot of hope for that catching on. Shelving Unit Assembly, Wicker versus Rattan Furniture Selection Guide. He looked up at Gabriel.
Sorry, mate, just a second. Jason resumed sorting through the pamphlets as Gabriel searched his still innocent-looking son's face for any hint of an explanation.
Basic guide to yogurt, Jason continued. Woven rug care in 5 easy steps. I've been looking for that one. Blue oyster bar. That one's for Rufus. Oh, here we go. Basic guide to amphora selection.
Jason handed over the pamphlet as he shoved the rest back into his inventory.
Note that the pictures show each amphora at the same size, Jason said, pointing. That's just to make use of the space on the pamphlet, though obviously any given amphora can come in any size. For clarity, you'll note there's a standard reference pair in each picture.
Gabriel looked at Jason like he was some kind of madman.
Reference pair?
That's industry standard, Jason said. I thought you said you were a collector.
I'm not a collector.
Then why did you say you were? Jason asked, anger and confusion splashed across his face.
Are you just here trying to dig up industry secrets? I told you about my slave workshop.
Slave workshop? indentured servants, whatever. Oh, this is a shocking turn-up.
I thought you were an adventurer.
Oh, it's always like that, isn't it? Jason said. You kill a few hundred monsters and suddenly all people see you as is an adventurer. Let me tell you, mate, adventuring is just a job. Pottery is a vocation. Jason yanked the pamphlet from Gabriel's hand.
Forget this, he said bitterly, stormed over to the terrace railing and vaulted over the side, dropping out of sight.
So that was Jason, Rufus said, mildly. Next, we'll head to the guest wing lounge and dining area, where I've had some lunch prepared.
Dear? Gabriel said.
Yes, my love?
Arabelle asked. She had remained silent throughout the encounter.
What just happened?
We just met Rufus's friend, dear, she said. Don't be judgmental.
Judgmental? The man was a loon.
He's from very far away, Arabelle said. He's bound to have some idiosyncrasies.
Idiosyncrasies? He tried to get me to invest in a pottery workshop staffed by slaves. He wouldn't stop saying amphora, and I still have no idea what bovril is.
I think it's a local delicacy where he comes from, Rufus said. Don't worry about it, Dad. I have food waiting.
Yes, do come along, dear,
Arabelle said, and set off with her son, Gabriel trailing after.
You set this up, Gabriel accused Rufus. This is for jumping off the ship in front of all those people, isn't it?
No idea what you're talking about, Dad.
You actually made pamphlets?
Gary asked, as Jason recounted the story later.
Yep, Jason said. 8 of them.
There's a simple ritual to print images, so the real issue was finding the right cardstock. For a good pamphlet, it has to be nice and thin, but firmer than just paper. Durable, with a good feel in the hand. They were sat around a banquet table in the guest wing lounge and dining area. It was Jason's full team, plus Gary, Belinda, Jory, Phoebe, Emir, and his chief of staff, Constance. Emir was laughing as Rufus led in his parents.
You,
Gabriel said, pointing at Jason, making Emir laugh all the harder.
Sit down and eat, Gabe, Emir said. Always a pleasure, Bella. You can sit next to me.
Keep your hands off my wife, Gabriel said, sitting down.
Connie, always a pleasure,
Arabelle said, sitting next to Constance.
Bella,
Constance greeted. Emir's usually reserved chief of staff seemed a little more relaxed than normal. Only a little, but it stood out.
Lovely to see you again, Jason said, and made introductions around the table.
When introducing Rufus's parents, he referred to his mother as an esteemed adventurer, venerated by kings and heroes. Gabriel he referred to as some kind of teacher.
I have a question, Gabriel said to Jason.
Just one?
How much of what you were saying to me was a lie?
All of it, Jason said. I was lying through my teeth. I'd probably mistake a kiln for a rustic barbecue and use it to cook sausages.
I'm a gold ranker, Gabriel said. I can see right through your aura.
Rude, but okay, Jason said.
Why couldn't I tell you were lying? It should have been in your aura.
Oh, that's a technique from my world called the Stanislavski system, Jason said. To grossly oversimplify, it's about becoming the person you're pretending to be in the moment.
It's a formidable tool, Arabelle said.
Especially when you run around making high-ranking enemies the way Jason does, Gary said.
What are you talking about? Jason said. Everybody loves me.
Speaking of which, Emir said, I was hoping you could help me with something, Jason.
Oh? Jason asked.
I thought I might take the opportunity of all these new adventurers arriving to try and bait out the Builder cultists, and I had an idea that makes use of your flair for pompous melodrama.
Pompous melodrama, Jason said, as laughter spread around the table at his hurt expression.
That's your problem? Emir asked. Not being used as bait for evil cultists.
No worries there, mate, Jason said. Evil cultists are kind of my thing.
Evil cultists are your thing? Phoebe asked.
Jason has a lot of things, Gary said.
I'm versatile, Jason said.
Chapter 34. I don't like this plan. The marshalling yard was full of adventurers, waiting for Emir Bahadir to arrive. The third and final boatload of iron rankers had arrived the day before, and a meeting had been called to finally explain the big job. Along with all the imported adventurers, the locals were out in full force. After the expedition, only those confident in their abilities were going to participate. But iron, bronze, or silver, everyone wanted to know what had brought Emir to Greenstone in the first place.
Asano!
The voice was loud and challenging, grabbing attention. Jason and his team were waiting with everyone else, looking up when someone called out Jason's name. Space was made as a young man strode through the crowd.
Asano!
The man said again.
Something I can help you with?
Jason asked.
You have one of your own team members as a slave?
The man asked.
Indentured servant, Jason said. Do you have a name, or should I just keep thinking about you as that loud guy who won't mind his own business?
Julian Cross, the man said.
All right, Julian, Jason said. What exactly does my team or my indentured servant have to do with you?
Letting an adventurer be an indentured servant is a disgrace. Relinquish her.
That wouldn't set her free, idiot. It's a court-ordered indenture, so they just put her contract up for auction.
Then you should transfer her contract to someone who won't treat her like a slave.
Says the guy who's talking about her instead of to her when she's standing right here.
Jason half turned his head in Sophie's direction.
What do you think? You want this guy to have your contract?
I'm not against getting away from you, she said. I think I can do better than him, though.
Not true, Julian said. I wouldn't treat you like a slave. You'd receive far better treatment than he would ever give you.
The thing is, Jason said, neither of you actually get a say. You, Julian, aren't involved at all, despite marching up and making a scene in front of all these people. As for you, woman, you belong to me.
Screw you, Sophie said.
If and when I say, Jason said, coldly. You think I'll just stand here and let you treat an adventurer like that? Julian asked. I challenge you.
Challenge me?
To a duel. There is a Mirage Chamber in this city, so I've heard. If you win, I shall withdraw from this event and return to my homeland. If I win, then you transfer the contract over to me.
If you want to duel, mate, there won't be any Mirage Chamber involved. You want to put something on the line, then it's your blood. Do you have a first blood rule in dueling here?
We do, Julian said.
Then we do it here and we do it now, Jason said. You and me. First blood.
Fine, Julian said. One blow is all I need to kill you anyway.
Space was quickly made, a circle of onlookers forming the borders of their impromptu arena. Julian and Jason circled each other, around 5 meters apart. Julian had the lean, athletic physique of most adventurers, with sharp, predatory features, swarthy skin, and a mane of amber hair. His hand rested lightly on the undrawn sword at his hip. Jason was on the other side of the encircling adventurers, shrouded in his cloak. In his hand was his conjured dagger, Ruin. The pair of combatants eyed each other off, each waiting for the opening that would give them the win. They circled slowly, each careful with their footwork, ready to move at any moment. Julian was the first to act. His sword erupted from its scabbard, a spark flashing from the blade and driving into Jason's cloak. The cloak was already empty. Jason had left it behind as he used it to shadow teleport. He rose behind Julian from his shadow, reaching around to slash Julian's throat. As Jason casually tossed aside his conjured dagger, which vanished into thin air, Julian clutched a hand over his throat,
blood seeping between his fingers. His other hand scrambled for a potion, which he tipped into his mouth. "First blood," Jason said. "You'd best have a healer look at that, mate. You're welcome for me not going deep, by the way." Julian pushed his way through the crowd, a hand still clutched over his throat. Jason turned around on the spot, casting a challenging gaze over everyone. "Does anyone else have a problem with me?" he called out. "That one was a warning. There won't be any more duels. You have a problem with me, either keep it to yourself or I will put you down. If any more people here have an issue with that, I can start right now."
"That's easy to say with Badadir standing behind you," someone called out from the crowd. "You think we don't know you've been staying in the Cloud Palace? You can talk big all you like, but it's not you that we're afraid of."
"Well said," Emir's voice boomed over the crowd from above. Everyone looked up to see Emir flying through the air, feet shrouded in a small patch of cloud. The cloud vanished, and he dropped lightly to the ground next to Jason.
"Jason," Emir said, "if you want to challenge any and all who come your way, then by all means do so. However, you must use your own strength to do so, not mine. I think it is time for my hospitality to come to an end before it starts to hinder your progress as an adventurer. The Cloud Palace is closed to you now."
"You can't do that," Jason exclaimed.
"I can, and have. Your order imprint will be wiped from the Cloud Palace's access list. This is for your own good. Relying on the strength of others will cause your own to atrophy."
"You think I need you?" Jason asked. "You just wait. You'll see what I can do on my own."
"I genuinely look forward to it."
Jason's rage-filled face was obscured as his cloak formed around him once again. Then the cloak was empty as he teleported away, drifting down for a moment before vanishing. Emir let out a world-weary sigh, then turned to the crowd.
"I realize there will be tension between locals and the newcomers, so let me be plain. As many of you have surmised, Jason Asano is under my protection. I am extending that protection to every Iron Ranker who signs on to the open contract I will be posting at the Adventure Society today, and that protection is the same for all, in both its extent and its limits. The protection is thus: every one of you must be fit for action when the contract begins in 3 days. I don't care what you do to one another, so long as you can be healed and ready for action at that time. That goes for Asano and each and every one of you."
The cloud appeared around Emir's feet again, and he floated into the air, rising slightly above the crowd.
"Now that is dealt with, we move on to the nature of the contract. Centuries ago, there was an ancient order of assassins known as the Order of the Reaper. They were hunted down and exterminated, but rumors always remained of a legacy left behind, a final hidden fortress. At the behest of a diamond rank client, I have spent the last few years searching the world for that fortress."
Emir panned his gaze over the group.
"As you have no doubt surmised, the fortress has been found here in the Greenstone region. There is a lake at the bottom of which the remains of that fortress have been long hidden. My people found it, but the true sanctum is not so easily penetrated. The legacy found therein comes with a test, a trial for who seek it out. It is held within an astral space that, even once unsealed, will only admit Iron Rankers. All attempts to otherwise penetrate it have fallen short. Only by activating the trials will it open, and only for those who have the longest road left to walk. Iron Rankers like you."
He paused, giving the crowd a few moments for his words to sink in.
"As I said, this fortress is at the bottom of a lake. My people will be on hand to grant you access, but reaching the depths, and they are depths, will be the first requirement of participation. If you cannot manage even that much, then there is no hope of you completing the trial anyway. All further details will be on the open contract, which will be posted shortly."
With that, Emir floated away. Many towns and villages in the Delta had accommodation just for adventurers. It always paid to make the people who killed the monsters for you welcome and comfortable. Certain hub locations were especially used to adventurers passing through, and people knew better than to take a second glance at the often oddly dressed and heavily armed individuals. Into one of the larger establishments strode two figures shrouded in dark cloaks. This was not unusual. More than a few young adventurers had become enamored with being mysterious. One of the cloaks was obviously magical, seemingly made from darkness itself. The other was a dark brown, plain but high quality. The two adventurers paid for one of the larger private rooms and went inside. Jason's cloak vanished, and Hester pushed the hood back on hers. Hester was the only Asiatic-looking person he had seen in this world outside of his own reflection. Her appearance was closer to South Asian than his own Japanese features.
"Where are you from, Hester?" he asked.
"Pranay, originally."
Jason was slowly learning about his new world, including the geography. Pranay was this world's equivalent of Sri Lanka, larger and further south than his own. It made for a huge landmass in the middle of what, in his world, was called the Indian Ocean.
"What's it like?"
"A lot like the Delta, actually," she said. "I became an adventurer to see the world, but now travel is so easy for me that I spend more and more of my time back home."
"That's nice," Jason said. "I'd like to be able to do that someday. My home's a little farther away, though."
"Nothing's impossible," Hester said. "Working for Emir, I've seen enough diamond rankers to learn that much. Even from what little I've witnessed, they function on a scale of power that's hard to believe."
Hester drew a circle in the air with her hand, which shimmered into being as a portal when she was done. They arrived in the Cloud Palace's guest wing lounge, where a large group was already having lunch. Emir and Constance, Belinda and Jory, Rufus and his parents, plus Gary and Jason's team. Julian was there as well, his throat injury fully healed. Jason nodded a greeting at Julian as he and Hester sat down.
"I didn't go too deep, did I?" Jason asked.
"No, it was perfect," Julian said.
"The potion alone was enough to deal with the damage. You know your throat slitting."
"You have no idea," Humphrey said. "I have this recording you should see."
"Will you stop showing that to people?"
"The bit where you let the spear hit you is the creepiest," Belinda said. "The way you pull it out and lick it, so disgusting."
"It really was," Jason said. "I think Jonah might have nicked a bowel."
"You don't have bowels," Clive said.
"I don't have bowels?"
"As essence users," Clive explained,
"we all go through physiological changes as we increase in rank. At iron rank, our digestion starts operating very differently. Our gold rankers here don't even need to breathe. Each time we rank up, in addition to making our bodies superior vessels for magic, there are changes to how our bodies operate. It's one of the reasons we can suffer more damage than others. Many of the vulnerable points in the torso are less vulnerable because we use what's in there less. By the time we reach silver and gold, we are mostly just containers for a living mass that serves to rapidly heal injury."
"Are you sure you don't want to come work for me?"
Emir asked.
"Stop trying to poach my team member," Jason said.
"I'm still unclear the point of what we did out there," Jason said. "I'm grateful for the opportunity, don't get me wrong. Coming to work for you, Mr. Bahadir, is a much better opportunity than some prize I likely wouldn't get. But I don't understand the purpose of setting the iron rankers on each other."
"Chaos," Jason said. "You've heard about the five people who were implanted with star seeds, yes?"
"Yes," Julian said.
"We're confident that the goal of implanting those people was to sow discord," Emir said. "One died, and we've captured and purged two of the others. Two remain at large, however, and the attention and resources we dedicate to finding them is attention and resources we aren't sending after the Builder cult."
Emir's declaration today basically gave everyone an opening to spend the next couple of days engaging in controlled chaos, Jason said. "The hope is that the Builder cult seeks to tip that chaos from controlled to uncontrolled in the lead up to the open contract, making it easier to enact their plans for the astral space."
"What's that got to do with you?" Julian asked.
Jason is now the focal point of this iron rank mess Emir has made, Gabriel said. He is close with Emir, but suddenly outside of Emir's protection. There wouldn't be a much better way to muddy the waters than implant Jason with a starseed, which we're hoping they attempt.
Even if they don't bite, it doesn't really cost us anything to try, Jason said.
What if they succeed and you actually get implanted? Julian asked.
That is the part that concerns me as well, Gary said. I don't like this plan.
Jason will be watched at all times, Emir assured him. I've brought in a specialist.
Emir nodded at a man sitting at the table that no one had noticed appear. He was a middle-aged man, the kind of grizzled that perpetually made him look like he should be in the wilderness somewhere, hunting something.
You had Hester bring in Cal, Gabriel said.
What my husband means to say is hello, Arabelle said. How have you been, Cal?
Busy,
Cal said, his voice as gravelly as his face.
It's good to see you, Bella. This is Callum Morse, Emir said. If he doesn't want to be seen, no one short of diamond rank will see him. He'll be over Jason's shoulder at every moment until the contract begins. Hopefully he'll bag us some builder cultists.
The lunch went on, the large group chatting away. Julian, Clive, and Neil were all quiet, intimidated by gold rank company. Although a born pedagogue, Clive was easily drawn out at the chance to explain one thing or another.
You know, Cal, Gabriel said, Jason here can keep lies out of his aura. You're the only other person I've seen do that.
How do you all know each other? Jason asked.
Oh, we were all a team, back when we were young and foolish, like you kids, Emir said. After we got to gold, though, our priorities started to shift. Cal here was happy to spend the rest of his days carving his way through the monster population, but he was having to look harder for a challenge. I wanted adventures more exotic than what the Adventure Society was offering, and took up fortune hunting for hire.
He waved a finger between Gabriel and Arabelle.
These two, he said, wanted to go off and make babies. Utterly pointless.
Excuse me, Rufus said. I am one of those babies.
And how long did it take you to be able to hold a worthwhile conversation? Emir asked. Children aren't a time-effective proposition.
I'd like children someday.
Constance opined quietly.
What's time, anyway?
Emir asked, course-corrected rapidly.
When you live as long as we do, what's a little time in return for the joy of parenting?
After lunch, Hester returned Jason to the guest house, from which they had portaled into the Cloud Palace. She did not remain behind, portaling away again while Sophie took Hester's position under the brown cloak. Jason and Sophie then left, ostensibly laying low after events in the marshalling yard, while leaving a trail for the builder cult to follow.
Chapter 35 Impossible to Subdue.
What is it you need me for?
Sophie asked.
You're not happy with enjoying a nice day in the Delta? They were strolling along an embankment road in the Delta, Jason setting their meandering pace.
It's not terrible, Sophie conceded. I'm just not sure why you need me to join you on the hook.
You know about fishing, but you didn't know about rain?
I probably heard someone mention it, but it isn't something that really comes up.
Seems like it would be, Jason said. Delta merchants, sailors, and you weren't born here, right? Didn't you come to this city on a ship? Surely that got rained on.
Who told you that? Was it Belinda?
Don't recall, Jason said. One of the Berts, maybe?
I don't really remember anything before Greenstone, Sophie said. I was very young. My earliest memories are of my father working for the Silver family.
My dad's done a lot of work for the government, Jason said. That's worse than working with criminals, believe me.
You didn't answer my question, Sophie said. Humphrey warned me about that.
Teenagers, Jason said, shaking his head. No discretion.
That's rich coming from you, she said.
This whole plan is formulated on you making a huge spectacle of yourself, which you did.
Sorry about the whole you-do-what-I-say woman thing.
I was kind of leaning into the villainy.
That seems to be your first reaction, she said. I've seen the recording of that ridiculous fight.
It was pretty over the top, right? I was just looking for a way to win. That meant killing a bunch of teenagers, so going movie monster seemed the natural choice.
Why do you do that? She asked.
Do what?
Make reference to things you know people won't understand. Is it part of the whole crazy persona you have going?
No, Jason said. Well, yes, probably. Where I come from, they call it a weirdness coupon. If people expect you to do strange things, then they accept it easier when you do. Have you ever noticed how people don't expect me to respect authority or adhere to ordinary codes of conduct?
I've been waiting for someone to kick the crap out of you for that.
It's happened once or twice, Jason said. But I get away with it, more than not. How many times have you seen me doing something absurd and have someone tell you, "Oh, that's just Jason"?
Quite a lot, actually.
And there you are, Jason said. I've never been good at fitting in, so I've learned how to stand out the right way. I admit that I've taken it pretty far here, but magic and monsters make everything bigger. Bigger personalities, bigger dangers. Half measures don't work, and you have to find a way to either make your mark or fade into the background. Getting caught in the middle will just get you chewed up and spat out. Go big or go home, as they say where I come from.
So all this strangeness is just an act?
Not at all, he said. There's method to the madness, sure, but there's also madness to the madness. It's about leaning into your strengths and working with what you've got. A lesson you could stand to learn, by the way.
What are you talking about? She asked.
Look at your circumstances before Clive and I came along, he said. You and Belinda, scrambling from one problem to the next. Every escape dropping you into a worse situation. The city tightening around you like a noose. You know why that is?
Because life sucks.
You've had some rough circumstances and no mistake, Jason conceded.
You went at them the wrong way, though. Is that so?
Sophie looked out at the marshes around the raised embankment road they walked along. Leaving the familiar streets of the city only heightened her sense of everything slipping from her control. I told you that you have to stand out or fade away, Jason said, or you'll get chewed up in the middle. You got chewed up pretty good. I've learned a fair bit about what you've been through and what you did about it, and it's plain to see what happened.
You think you know me? She asked.
I'm starting to get there, he said. You kept choosing to fade into the background, but everything you did was about making your mark. You've been telling yourself you're doing one thing, while you're really doing the opposite.
So you know what I really should have done?
Not at all, Jason said. I haven't lived your life or faced your circumstances. Compared to you, my life has been sunshine and rainbows. But you have to realize that you're never going to fade into the background. It's not just the way you look, although that's certainly a thing.
You have a problem with the way I look?
Of course I don't, Jason said. I'm a straight man with eyes. But the way you look is a perfect reflection of who you are. Your hair, your clothes, you choose them for practicality. They shout to the world that you want to do your thing and don't want anyone to bother you. But they can't hide what you are.
And what's that? She asked, voice thick with challenge.
Fierce, arresting, indomitable. If you asked Cole Silver or Lucian Lamprey why they chased after you, they'd probably say it was because of the way you look. Maybe that's how it started, but it's not why they kept chasing so hard for so long. They'd be lying, especially to themselves. A certain kind of man is insecure about his power. If he senses a challenge to it, he has to possess or destroy whatever is making him feel challenged.
Is that what you think? You're reading too much into a pair of sleazy guys used to getting what they want.
That's the whole point of what I'm saying, Jason said. They didn't get what they were after. I might have come along at the end, but Lamprey had been chasing you for months, Silver for years from what I've heard. If you weren't captured by my resourcefulness and dashing good looks, you'd probably still be out there.
Wasn't it mostly Clive who caught us?
I did most of the fighting and chasing.
Like a minion, while he did all the setup, like a boss.
Wouldn't that make you Belinda's minion?
I'm all right with that.
That's actually really nice, Jason said. That level of trust.
You don't have people you trust?
Actually, I'm thick with them, Jason said. I didn't have a lot of friends back home. Someone hurt me, made it hard to trust people. I did a lot of getting chewed up in the middle from being too afraid to embrace what I really am.
A nonsensical loon?
Yes, he said. This world forced me to answer new challenges, to be more than I was, and to find people I could trust and rely on. I could have stayed quiet, worked my way up as another unremarkable Iron Ranker. But you know what? I am remarkable, for good or ill. He gave her a wry smile. So are you, whether you like it or not. Most people faced with your circumstances would capitulate, endure to get by. You didn't. You took extreme measure after extreme measure, even as you told yourself you were trying to lay low. You're so bad at taking the quiet road that you followed it right into a storm of politicians, crime lords, and adventurers. You can't hide because you burn too bright. Until you accept that, you're just going to keep getting chewed up. She didn't respond, thinking as she threw him wary glances.
What does indomitable mean?
She asked, finally. Impossible to subdue, Jason said.
I'm your indentured servant.
Are you, though? Jason asked. If you wanted to be gone, could I have stopped you? I don't imagine for a second that Belinda hasn't figured out how to slip that tracking bracelet. You probably got something on your person right now that will let you do it if you need to. They walked in silence for a long time.
You still didn't answer my question,
she realized out loud. What question?
Why do you need me out here with you?
You're easier to track, he said.
And you're not easy to track.
Nope. I have a power that makes it hard.
No actual skills, then.
None whatsoever, he said, pumping a fist in the air. Magic powers for the win!
Why are you so proud about something you didn't earn?
Pride is an easy lever to pull, Jason said. You should never let people know what you're actually proud of.
Are you ever not manipulating people?
We all manipulate the people around us, Jason said. We all show different faces to friends, family, colleagues, enemies.
You think that's the same thing?
You think it's different? You think my friends don't see past the bombast and the bluster? Do you think Jory doesn't know how I feel, healing people in his clinic? That Humphrey doesn't know my pride helping protect a village from monsters? That Rufus doesn't feel my triumph when I push my abilities a little bit further and grow that little bit stronger?
Aren't you just making it harder for them?
We all make it hard. Rufus can be rigid when he needs to be flexible. Humphrey can be short-sighted when he needs to look deeper. Jory needs to be more ambitious before he can truly accomplish the things he wants to. As for me, well, I'm the worst of the lot. I'm constantly causing trouble a little politeness would avoid. I pick fights I have no business being in, make enemies that would overlook me if I just learned to keep my mouth shut. I'm prickly, manipulative, completely lacking in deference.